Good morning. So, last time we talked about what POSIX was, which you said was the standard for Unix, because people created like 8 different kinds of Unix and they all wanted to have source code compatibility among them. So POSIX specified, here's what application programmers see, so here are the library calls and also how the shell works. So you can make programs that work on everything with just a recompile, so you can distribute your commercial software that works on people's expensive Sun Microsystems, which used to be a company server, and people's expensive IBM servers, and not have to worry about most of your application needing customizing for each particular kind. We talked about the more general idea of process control blocks, the idea that we have to have some structure where we keep information about each process. And we looked at what was in that structure for XV6. And we talked about the Unix API for creating processes and starting programs. And one of the more confusing things about this is that they separate the operation of creating a new process, which is done with fork, from the operation of starting a new program, which is done with exec. When you create a new process, the new process you're creating is a copy of an existing one, where copy means that it's running in the exact same place from when you made the copy. And we use exec to change our current process from running one program to running a new program from the beginning. We also have wait PID because when we execute a program, we often want to wait for it to finish and figure out whether it was successful or not. And wait PID is the way of doing that. It's called wait PID because it takes a process ID, something that identifies one of those process control blocks. So we can indicate what process we want to wait for. We also have the option of just saying, wait for any of my child processes, that is any of the processes that were made from copies of me. So any questions about anything we covered last time? Yes?
Is an exec ever something that the programmer is deliberately trying to do?
So the question is exec something a programmer will do, presumably you mean without fork?
Yes.
So with fork, exec is how you spawn a process. So like if you're writing, say, a shell and you want ls to work, you're going to fork and then exec ls, because it's the only way you can start ls. And if, for example, you want to run a program and you don't care about figuring out whether it completed, you just want to run it and forget about it, maybe you'll just exec without forking because you don't have anything more to do. It doesn't come up that often, but you see it on occasion. I guess we'll probably have one example of that near the end of class today. Other questions? Okay, so first, a logistical note. As I mentioned very early in this class, we're gonna have post-quizzes, so quizzes on the stuff we theoretically covered in lecture that week. There's a link off the course website, it's at the top of the website, there's a link called quizzes. It should work as of today, or at least it will work as of tomorrow when the quiz is released. For now, we're planning on having them available Friday morning. This means that if I discover at the end of this lecture that I didn't cover what I expected to, I can modify the quiz I have written and not ask you questions about things you don't know. And can do that in spite of teaching 2 sections of 30 through 30 after this. It's the same software as CS 30 through 30. If you haven't used that before, you go to the quiz, there's multiple choice answers. When you select an answer, the box will turn green if your answer is recorded. If it stays yellow, there's some sort of network problem. If it's not your network, let us know. There's no time limits, unlike 30 through 30. So you can start the quiz at any time. You can finish it. You can modify your answers up until the deadline, which is 9:15 Tuesday morning. That's conveniently before this class, because I do not want people doing the quiz in class instead of possibly paying attention to lecture. Okay, any questions about those quizzes? And so there'll be one every week except exam weeks, basically. It's on the schedule. Yeah?
How many questions are you doing?
It's going to be similar in length to 30-30, if you remember that. So like 4 or 5 multiple choice type questions. So it should. The idea is that it should be pretty short. It's open book, open notes. Just please do not like post the question on Piazza or Stack Overflow or I Am Your Friends or Your Enemies. Okay. So I'm going to start by talking about shells. And I think we ended with this last time. So a shell is what we have to allow a user, you know, the person at the keyboard to run applications. So this is the user's wrapper around all those process management functions we saw. And the upcoming homework, for those of you who've peeked, is going to be to make a simple shell. And a shell takes a whole lot of forms. So you've seen a shell, you've used bash or sh in, you know, SSHing into machines. You probably had to do something involving a shell in 2150 and probably some other courses. Where you have this command line. The command line is a shell because it runs other programs. Like, its job is basically to take some input and then do fork exec wait PID. There's also graphical shell. So the OSX Finder, you can call a shell. It just doesn't have a command line. It has a graphical interface, but its job is to let you run programs. So it's doing the same kind of thing. And the Windows Explorer, so on. So shells aren't limited to what you see in POSIX, but because we're talking about POSIX, we're going to implement the kind of shell you see on POSIX systems, i.e. the Unix command line. We're going to implement a serious subset to keep things simple. And so this should be reasonable to do in a week, though it will be a lot more code than the XV6 intro assignment. Not that that's surprising, given how much code it is. My solution's like order 100, 200 lines. I'm not trying to make it short, but you know, that's sort of the length I expect. I would note, since I understand in prior semesters this is something that people haven't realized, that you are permitted and encouraged to use C++ in the assignments that aren't XV6 in this class, like the assignments where we have you write a normal application. And this seems like a good idea for the shell assignment because, like, maybe you'd like to use a vector instead of C arrays, especially if you're dealing with like list of like arguments. Maybe you'd like to use the string class instead of char pointers, especially if you're dealing with strings. And I think this is one of the things which has historically made this assignment harder than it should have been, because people, even though Grimshaw always thinks he's allowed C++ and his assignments always said they did, people didn't realize that. Yes, you could actually use like vector. Okay, so let's talk about some features of the POSIX command line. So one of the things that it does is it searches for programs. And we mentioned this last time we talked about the path environment variable, that when you type ls minus l, we have to know, where is ls? How do I run it? So we have some way of finding out that, oh, on my system, ls is in the slash bin directory. So there's some list of places to look. We learn that that's in the path environment variable. So it's one of the things that's passed when the shell was started by whatever program started it. And one of the things it passes to all the programs it starts is this list of locations to look. And part of the shell's job is to do the work of, instead of just doing exec of ls and assuming ls is in your current directory, it says, okay, you typed ls, let me look in /bin/user/bin until I find it. So without that, you'd have to do things like always say, oh, I want to run /binls, I want to run /userbinmake. The shell you implement for the assignment, we will not require you to do searching the path, which means that when you test it, you'll have to do the long, annoying version of commands. But you'll have to write less code, probably worth it. for your work. Shells also support running things in background. So you can use ampersand, and that says, don't start that, don't wait for that program right away. Let's just run that program and wait for it later. So both of these are features that you, I think, know how to implement from what we discussed. So it's not obvious how you do the searching, because you might think, well, you didn't tell me how to see if a file exists. But there's a way of doing it without that, which is just that you just call exec on everything in the path until it works. Because when it doesn't work, it's just going to keep going. So you just keep calling exec. And if it never works, you print an error. And if it does work, well, you found it. And for running in the background, we know how to do that. So we learned wait PID is how we wait for a program. So here, instead of using wait PID right away, we use wait PID later on. Or we just don't use it until we use it, you know, some later time, rather than not accepting our next command until wait PID returns. And one thing we didn't discuss is that wait PID has a way of requesting that you don't wait. So this is an example of running something in the background. And the shell that I have prints a done message when it finishes. So what it was doing, probably, is it used wait PID later on. And one thing we didn't discuss is that there was this options argument that I always showed 0 being passed to in wait PID. One of the options is don't hang if the process isn't done yet. Only return if it's return immediately. If it's done, give me its status code. If it's not done, just tell me it's not done. And so the simplest way of implementing it was just with that extra option, where wait PID will say, you know, I'll give you the status if it's done. Otherwise, I'll tell you it's not done. Sorry. So then we have two other options, which have to deal with files. And that's going to be most of our discussion today. So one of them is redirection. You've maybe used this. And this is that we can make a program's output, instead of being our terminal, be some file. And we can make a program's input, instead of being our terminal, be some file. And so the idea is that, you know, it's kind of like we copied and pasted the file for input, and kind of like we copied and pasted the output into the file for output. The mechanism isn't like that. The shell isn't collect the output. We're going to take advantage of something we saw with how processes run. When we, you know, did fork, one of the things it does is it copies the open files. So we can open a file, fork, and the file is still open. And these open files, you know, also get preserved. You know, this is also not changed. By exec. So exec preserves these too. So if we just set up the open files in the way we want them, so the file which represents our output is that, you know, output.txt, that's how we implement redirection. So we're just going to make, when we exec the program, we're going to make those open files be not our terminal, but be the files we want to redirect to or from. So a typical pattern you might use for this is that we, you know, fork, and in the child, we open some new files, and then we exec. And this shows us one of the advantages of fork as a way of doing process creation, that if we didn't have that and we wanted to support this feature, we need to have some extra arguments to exec saying, where do you want the input to be from? Where do you want the output to be from? And here we kind of got that for free. Yes?
So when you're running the exec file, do you just pass in the redirection character as a
So the question is, what happens to the redirection operation in our arguments list? And the answer is that the shell is not going to include it. So the shell is going to use the redirection for this. And this is not, you know, no, it's not going to be included there. So it's going to be already processed earlier. Are there questions about this pattern? Yeah.
What's the precedent in a pipeline for input redirection versus output redirection?
What's the precedent for input redirection versus output redirection? So they don't interfere with each other, except for the issue of what if you try to read and write from the same file? And the answer is don't do that, mainly because the output redirection I've shown you truncates the file.
If you're reading from left to right, how do you talk to the input redirection?
If you do go from left to right, how do you do?
On the shell pipelines, if you're going from left to right, then there's like an input, and then that's being output somewhere. What's the preference?
So the question is, if I input an output somewhere, so if I input an output from the same file in the same line of my shell, and I assume you're referring to like there being a pipeline, so there's multiple things being executed. So the answer is that we're going to spawn, like if we have, we'll talk about pipelines in a second, and we'll see that there's a problem that multiple things are going to be happening at once, which is going to make that just unsafe. So I'll get to that in a second. So yes, so standard error output, standard error are files. Your terminal is a file. So after forking, typical pattern is you open files to redirect. You could also do it before forking. It's probably less convenient because you need to like restore the terminal for the parent process, but you could. And you have to somehow make them be standard out and standard error. And we have not talked about how you do this. That's something we're going to talk about today. We also haven't really talked about how you open files, though you've probably seen some form of opening files because you probably had to open a file at some point in your CS career. So the other thing is pipelines. So this is the thing alluded to where multiple programs are run. And so the idea here is that we take the output of this some program and put it into some filter as the input. So this is basically the same as if we had done some program go to temp.txt, and then did some filter from temp. From that file, except that there's no waiting for some program to complete. It gets the input from the other program as it's produced. Like there's no waiting for the file. And the way pipelines work is that we're going to run both the programs at the same time. So that means that if we had redirections in here, like you asked, that went to the same file, we'd be in kind of trouble because we'd be reading and writing from the file at the same time. And unless the programs are designed to coordinate that, they're going to probably get very confused. Because like they'll read the file and it's not being finished writing, they'll read GOF, what's happened? Because these, so in a pipeline, these programs, we're actually going to run them at the same time. So the pattern we'll see later is we're going to start some program, we're going to start some filter, and we're going to somehow set them up so one's output is the other's input, but they're going to be running simultaneously, and we'll wait for them both to finish afterwards. We're not going to run some program, then some filter. We're going to run them both, wait for them both, and then ask for the next command. So one of the simplifications you can see here in the shell assignment is that we have, you know, let some features you're not implementing. You're not implementing searching paths. You're not implementing background programs. Another simplification is that, you know, that you're, you know, have some simplified parsing. So we require in the assignment that the redirection operator is surrounded by spaces. So this is not allowed. You have to do this. This just is going to make your job easier because you can just separate the line into words, and we in fact give you a code snippet which should do that, and just look at all the array of words rather than like trying to go character by character. And similarly for pipelines, we require the pipe character to appear with two spaces around it, so you can still separate the line into words. And you also don't have to deal with things like quotes. If you have quotes, you just separate it into words, say the quotes are part of the words, and so on. Another thing your shell has to do that the command line you used doesn't do is it has to print the exit code of the programs you run. Yes?
So when we do a pipeline, both programs are running simultaneously?
Yes. Yes, when you do a pipeline like this, both programs will run simultaneously. So in this example, we'll run ls minus 1 and bin grep at the same time. So ls minus 1 will be printing out names of files, while bin grep is filtering those files for foo and sending the output to temp.txt. Yes?
Can that screw up if you don't have the right, the first program is providing the input to the second program?
So can't that screw up? So if the programs are written properly, no. But if you weren't expecting your input to be another program, yes, you could have some confusion, and we'll see an example of why later. Okay, so let's talk about files. So all the fancy features we're implementing with our shell, which aren't just running programs, have to do with changing the files the programs have. So we're going to talk a bunch about the file API. And the file, as I alluded to earlier in the semester, is this one interface we have for devices, for what we call files on disk, which POSIX calls, actually, in the standard, regular files. That's the term they use. And for networking, there's something called sockets we'll talk about much later in the semester, which are files. For talking between programs locally, most notably, there's something called pipes, which is in fact the mechanism by which one program's output will be the other's input. And these are all files, and they're all files because they have the same basic interface. You open them somehow, you read them or write them, and you close them, and all these read and write operations are in terms of bytes. We read some bytes, we write some bytes. That's how we interact with all these files. And there are some key aspects. So the open is a key part. So when we do the open, some setup happens, and also access control happens. When I open a file, that means I can read it if I opened it to read. That means I can write it if I opened it to write. The operating system doesn't check later whether I can do that. I know I can read the file because I opened it for reading. So this means that when we make a read call, that we're not double checking, can this process really read this? We already know because we checked on open. They're byte oriented, which means that if our file represents something which doesn't work in terms of bytes, which turns out to be a lot of things, the operating system is going to hide that from us. So disk, for example, don't work in terms of bytes. So spinning disks work in terms of what are called sectors, which are usually like at least 512 bytes, sometimes like 4 kilobytes. And the operating system is going to let us read bytes of a file on disk, even though that's not how the hardware works. So it's going to have to close that gap and let us work in terms of bytes. There's also an explicit close. The operating system's not going to clean up the files for us, except if our process goes away. It's going to know, oh, you aren't using any of those anymore. But generally, when we stop using a file, we're going to have to close it. Or do something which lets the OS know to close it, like exit. Yes? So the question is, if you don't get an error from open, you're free to read, but what about network errors? So by free to read, I mean you're allowed to read. I don't mean that your read is successful. So I want to distinguish between things that you're not allowed to do and things which are errors. So you can certainly get errors. You can get them even for regular files. You try to read and we find out that the disk is broken. The OS is not going to give you some bytes. It's going to tell you, sorry, the disk broke. So since we're hiding this aspect that real devices aren't byte-oriented, there is going to be buffering, typically in the kernel, to implement files in this POSIX API. So let's say we have our program, and we're interacting with a keyboard and a disk. And we're going to do this via files, where we're going to read and write characters. So on my keyboard, I press a key, and the program isn't reading yet. So what the operating system is going to do is it's not going to just tell the keyboard, OK, sorry, the program wasn't reading. I'm not going to use that key press, because that doesn't work the way we want it to. It's going to say, OK, I got a key press. I'm going to keep track of that. I'm going to put that in a buffer that I control to remember that a key was pressed and let the keyboard give me more key presses. It has to take the key press. Otherwise, the keyboard has very, very little space to remember key presses, and it's going to run out. And later on, the program's actually going to read, and the operating system, typically, I already pressed the key. It's going to go via the buffer. If I didn't press the key, it's going to wait until that buffer fills up and then send me the key I pressed. So we have this sort of gap in time where I press the key at one time, and I could call read at some other time to actually read those characters. So similarly, let's say I'm reading a file. So I read a character from a file, and that file's on disk. But the disk, as I said, it works in these big blocks called sectors. So I'm going to need to actually read a whole block of data from the disk as the operating system. And I could just read the whole block of data, get the single character you asked for from it, and return it to you. And then when you read the next character, I read that block of data again, get the single next character you asked for, and return it to you. But that's typically not how the operating system's going to work, because that's really slow. So instead, we're going to read the whole block of data from disk. We're going to keep it around in the kernel because we know that the next thing you read, we might be able to read from that buffer for you and not actually go to disk again. And basically, for all kinds of devices, we're going to have, for reading, we're going to have this sort of buffering where we keep some data in the kernel and actually, try to satisfy the reads from this buffer. And this is part of dealing with the gap that the real devices don't work in bytes, or the real devices, we expect them to hold things that happened earlier, like for the keyboard. And buffering is also going to happen on writes. So I print a character, let's say, to a remote machine. I'm running in SSH, so I print something, and that's going to go to a remote machine, like my laptop that's SSHing into a server. And the network isn't always available to send things. We have to wait a bit of time. So the operating system is going to have a buffer of output that's waiting to go on the network. And whenever that network device says it's ready to send the data, it's going to actually use that buffer and send stuff from the buffer. And typically, our print operation, we're going to say it's completed when we put the data in the buffer. We're not typically not going to wait to return from that write operation until it actually goes out on the network. We're typically going to say, OK, it's in the buffer. It's going to go on the network. I'm done. You can keep going, program. Do whatever you want to do. And similarly, when we write a character to a file, we have to write to the hard disk in these big blocks. So we're just going to put a buffer of data we're waiting to write to disk. And sometime later on, when the disk is ready to write that, we're going to write it. And in a typical operating system, we're going to say, OK, you wrote a character. You know, with a normal API, we're going to say, okay, it's in my buffer, I'm done with the write, it's written to the file. You might have complaints about this from the terms of, what if I lose power? Well, it's not written on disk. But this is a lot more efficient than if every time I asked to write a character, we wrote that whole block to disk and waited for the disk to be ready to do that. And so this is typically how all our files are going to work, is that the read operation is going to try to read from this buffer, and if not, we'll wait for the buffer to be filled up. The write operation, we're going to get it ready to send to wherever it needs to go, and then we're done. And later on, it's going to get drained from that buffer in the operating system. So read-write, what they really are doing is they're moving data into and out of a buffer. And if the buffer happens to be empty or full, we'll wait. Otherwise, we won't. So, you know, on read, if we look at the buffer of characters I typed in the keyboard and there's not enough to satisfy the read, we might say, okay, sorry, I'm going to just hold this process for a while until I get more characters. And for a write, if I say, okay, you have, you know, 10 kilobytes of stuff to send to that remote machine, I'm not going to keep all of that. I might wait until I have a bit more space to put your stuff. It's until some stuff goes over the network, so I don't buffer like a whole megabyte of stuff, you know, that hasn't gotten saved yet. So this is the default behavior. There typically are ways, which we won't discuss, of changing this behavior and saying, no, operating system, when I write to this file, I want you to wait until it's actually on the disk. But that's not the default behavior. If you don't do anything, when you're writing or reading, it's just going to this buffer, so it's ready to get to the device. And when you're reading, it's reading from some buffer, you know, that may have been read earlier or received earlier. Yes?
When you do a write followed by a flush, is that effectively mimicking that, like, the sequence of behavioral information?
So the question is, when you do a write followed by a flush, is that doing this? And the answer is no. So here we have no flush operation. The write sends gets it out of your process, and from that point on, as far as we know, there's nothing you can do. So the flush operations you've seen earlier with like printf are doing the write operation and nothing else. They're getting it out of your program, they're not getting it out of the operating system. You need to do more work to get it out of the operating system. And an example of something which would do that, which is not flush, would be, there's a call, fsync would be an example. Fsync is a system call which says, please get this data on disk, basically. Doesn't precisely say that, but it says something like that. But without something like that, nothing you've seen before actually does this. Like, so fflush does not deal with these buffers. It deals with a different buffer, and we'll talk about the interaction between the read and write we'll talk about and the read and writes you've used, which are different. They're built on top of it, actually. I guess this is a good time for this picture. Yes? So the buffer we're talking about is located in the kernel. And I guess some of the confusion is that we have things like printf and cout, which are located here in the standard library. And these have there's a buffer for cout and for printf up here in the standard library when you're running your program. Read and write typically are actually system calls. And the buffer for read and write is down here in the kernel, below the system call interface. And so this, if you've seen, so who here has used something like fflush or I don't know what the equivalent in Cout is, so you probably haven't used it. Or if you have, maybe. So these things have buffers. So printf and Cout have their own buffers. And this is what fflush, for example, deals with. But these are separate from the buffers that exist in the kernel, in the operating system itself, not in the standard library that read and write use. And yes, this means when you use printf, there are two sets of buffers. There's a buffer in your program, in the library, which gets sent to via read and via write calls to a buffer in the operating system, which gets sent to the screen. So, questions on this? Wait, well, yes.
So, is this a problem? Is this a problem with the buffer? Is when the set of the library buffer has finished writing to the buffer, or when the library function has finished writing into the buffer?
So, the question is the read and write system call only finished when the library functions are finished writing into the buffer? So, for printf and cout, they have some policy on when they send the stuff in their buffer actually to the operating system through read and write. That policy is typically not as bad as when the buffer is full. So for example, for printf, if you're outputting to a terminal, the policy is on new lines, I send the contents of the buffer. And that's obviously convenient because otherwise you print a line and you don't see it. But they have some rule about that. For most of today, we're not going to show things using printf or cout. We're going to show stuff that directly uses read and write, where there's no buffer involved because we're using the system calls. So we're skipping the standard library's buffer and just going directly to the kernel, to the kernel's raw file interface. People still look confused. Yes. That's pointing to the standard library, sorry. These are all part of the standard library.
And the read-write is to
the kernel file. Yeah, the read-write is part of the system calls, I should say. So it goes, it's what goes between the standard library and the kernel file interface. Yes?
Why might you want to bypass the standard library?
Why would you want to bypass the standard library? So, we'll talk about that later, I guess. We'll try to get back to that later when there's, yeah.
So, is all system calls doing is taking from the library buffer and running it, or like feeding to the kernel buffer?
Is all the what is doing?
Is all system calls doing is taking it from one buffer to the other buffer?
As the standard library uses it, yes. That's what the standard library will make these system calls, and when it's doing it, it's copying from its buffer and hopefully getting it into the kernel buffer. Okay. So another thing we have to deal with files is something I think you've seen before, which is our notion of the file system, that we have regular files, which are named collections of bytes that we read and write, and directories, which are this hierarchy which contains regular files. And this is important because our open operation takes a file name. And this is how file names are organized. So we'll have an operation other than open, which does the same kind of thing for creating some special types of files like pipes. But the idea of any of these is that this creates a new file for us to deal with. But I'll start with open because it's the one which deals with regular files, so it's the simplest to explain. So this is the open call in POSIX. It has two prototypes. You might say, how is that possible in C? But it is, kind of. And here are some example calls. And it has argument path, it has an argument flags, and it has a last argument called mode. So the path argument is the file name. So it's a const char star pointer. It just says, what file do we want to open? And we saw, I think everyone here has seen, understands what these paths mean. Probably. And You know, notice that sometimes these use a notion of the current directory. If you remember when we looked at the struct proc in XV6, that was one of the members of the process structure. So that's how we know where to look for the directory quux in. As we look at our struct proc, say, where's the current directory? And open returns an int. And this return value is something we call a file descriptor. And this is an index into a table of what POSIX calls open file descriptions for each process. And this index is what we're going to pass to all our system calls with deal with open files. So anytime we want to refer to an open file, we're going to give this index into a table for our process. And we, in fact, saw this table in XV6. We literally have an array of struct files, which are our open files. And the file descriptors in XV6 are just an index into this array. So file descriptor 0 is index 0. That's what it refers to. And we have to use that because, well, we're not going to keep a pointer to the OSS memory in the system call interface. We're just going to supply something simpler. And that simpler thing is the index into the array. Note that this is a pointer to a file. And these pointers can be shared between processes. So two processes can have copies of the same pointer in their table. And for example, this is how things will be after fork. So when fork does its copy, copying the struct files is not part of what it does. It just copies the pointers. So they're pointers to the same struct file with the same information, and we'll see what's in a struct file on the next slide. And when we don't have a file open, there's just a null pointer. And if you pardon that, I can't apparently remember to revise slides. Let's just do. Well, this is not, yeah. So there's not supposed to be these stray marks here. But we have, this is the struct file in XV6. It has a type. So there are a couple types of files. We have the none type for, this is not a used entry. We have the pipe type, which is for, this is to communicate between two processes. And we have a type called inode. We'll see much later in the semester where that name comes from. But that represents a regular file, like a file on disk. We have a reference count. So this is the number of pointers to this struct file. And this is used to safely delete this when we're done. So one of the things fork does is it just copies the pointers, but it increments this reference count so we remember to not delete it too early. Because we want to, you know, deallocate the struct file only when all pointers to it go away. We have some flags, and then I meant to highlight this. We have our readable and writable flag, which is, should reads and writes be allowed? This is something that's set on open. And we'll see the corresponding flags to open, which request this. And this is remembered here. So when we do a read, we don't have to check the rest of the information. We just look at this and say, was reading allowed? You know, are you permitted to read this file or not with this open file? And we also have our offset in the file, which is the location in the file for files where that's meaningful. So for a pipe, that's not really meaningful, but for something like a regular file on disk, this is what byte are we at in the file on disk. And note that this can be shared between two processes. So if you fork, they share the offset. So if one reads, that advances where the other is when it reads the next time. And I apologize for having stray numbers on this slide, which I will fix when I upload these. So let's talk about special file descriptors. So there's just a convention for what input and output are. So file descriptor 0, just by convention, that's where input comes from. There's nothing actually special about file descriptor 0. We just decided when we made POSIX that index 0 into the table is where will look for input the way we write the standard library. So the standard library's scanf or cn just knows to use index 0 because that's hard-coded. Index 1 is standard output, so cout just knows to use index 1 because it's hard-coded. And cerr knows to use index 2, which is standard error because that's hard-coded. Or also standard error if you've used fprintf and c. And POSIX provides constants for these called standard in underscore file no, standard out underscore file no. These are just constants which evaluate to 0, 1, and 2. They're the file descriptor number for input, output, and error. But there's nothing actually special about them. They're just happen to be the first three entries in the table. And we'll talk later about, well, I want to redirect, how do I choose the number? So open also has flags. So the flags are a bitwise OR of a bunch of options. So one of them is, am I right opening read-write, read-only, or write-only? And you can also specify some other things, which you've probably seen reflected when you've done opening files in a higher level library, like do I want to append? Do I want to truncate the file? Do I want to like set its length to 0 if I'm like writing it, rather than overwriting things that are there but leaving what's there already? Do I want to create a new file? If you don't specify that, even if you're opening for writing, it's going to say, oh, that file doesn't exist, unless you specify create. And there's an OExclusive is fail if the file already exists, which is typically used with create to say, you know, I want to create a new file, but I don't want to overwrite an existing file. And these are all documented in the manual page. There's also a mode argument, which we won't talk about much, which is the permissions if we're creating a new file. It's optional because if you aren't creating a new file, you don't need to provide it. And typically you provide 0666. It uses the same numbers as chmod when it takes numbers. Typically it's specified in octal like that is. That's a base 8 constant. We're not going to deal much with this, at least not until much later in the semester, which is why I'm kind of glossing over this. And you're usually right if you just use 0666, which specifies readable and writable. Okay, so talking about open, and I mentioned read and write. So read and write, they take a file descriptor, they take a buffer in user space, like your buffer to copy from, and a number of bytes to copy. And they return the number of bytes they actually read or wrote, or negative one if some error happened, like an IO error, like the disk is broken, or like you specified a file descriptor that wasn't open, something like that. And when they return an error, and we'll see this pattern for everything we deal with in POSIX, the error code is an error no. If you want to figure out what error actually happened. Read returns 0 when you reach end of file. So this is how you know when I reach the end of my input. So if I'm reading from a regular file, this is how I know I've reached the end of the file. If I'm reading from a pipe, this is how I know I've reached the end of the other program's input and it finished, versus I'm still waiting for more input from that program. So if your program is written correctly, and you asked this earlier, you'll wait until read returns 0 before you assume you're done with your input. So let's look at an example of read. So here, this is reading one byte at a time into a C++ string. So I call read, and I forgot a parentheses here. And while it's greater than 0, while I've read something, you know, I add that. If I get negative 1, then some error happened. I can use the pr function to print out what the error was. So it will print out something like IO error, you know, or hopefully some kind of useful message. And if I get a 0, I reach the end of the input. There was nothing more to read. So note that I said read and write read up to that number of bytes, and then return the number they actually read. So they can read less than requested, which means that if you want to read some amount, like you can call read once with like 1,024 bytes to read, and even if there's that much input, you might not get it all at once. And the biggest example where this will happen is with a pipe. Read's going to return what's available now, if there's something, typically, for a pipe. And it's not going to wait and see if the program actually produces a kilobyte of input. You know, it's going to give you the input that exists now, rather than stalling potentially forever. And you have to call it again to see, does the program have more input for me if I'm reading from another program? So you'll typically end up with a loop something like this, where you, if you want to read a whole lot of, you know, some exact number of bytes, where you'll have to keep trying to see, you know, okay, you had 100 bytes for me, maybe the program's going to output something again, let's wait for that. And the usual policy with read and pipes is that it's going to give you what's there if there's anything there, otherwise it's going to wait for something to be written to the pipe and then give you that. Now with regular files, and this is where people get in trouble, you don't have this, right? When you read a byte, a kilobyte from a regular file, of course it's all going to be there or not. But when you're reading from a network or something like that, it's not going to work that way. So you have to be aware of that. And also applies to reading from the keyboard. You know, if there's only one line of keyboard input and you ask for a kilobyte, that doesn't mean there won't be another line, but it's going to give you the first line. So write works similarly. So you specify a buffer, an amount to write, and that copies it into the kernel, and hopefully it eventually goes where you care about it going, like to the screen, to the network, to a file. And in real code, you want to do some error checking, and you might need to deal with write not writing everything you asked it to write, just like with the read. Now, partial writes don't happen as often, so they're less of a concern than partial reads. Partial reads all the time. You read from the keyboard, not all the input's there. Read from another application, not all the input's there yet. But partial writes, typically write's going to wait until it can write all your output before it returns. There are two notable exceptions. So one is on error. Like, if I'm writing to a file and then I run out of disk space, that write is going to say, well, I wrote some stuff. And it's going to return that, and you have to try again to find out, oh, I'm out of disk space. Another example is if you get interrupted, which there are ways of, like, you know, with signal handlers, which we won't talk about much, of causing something else to run in your process during the write, and that will cause the write to stop short. So typically, though, write will wait till it completes, so it's less of a concern, with the notable exception that you might not notice some errors happen, like if you run out of disk space or like your network connection gets unplugged in the middle of sending something to a remote server. So I also have close. So close deallocates a file descriptor. So it closes the file descriptor, deallocates the array index in XV6. This means setting it to null. And it also means changing that reference count, and if this is the last pointer to that open file struct, getting rid of it, actually deallocating its memory. And close can technically fail, though I don't know of almost no one who actually checks. Like one example is that some systems won't detect you run out of disk space until you close a file you're trying to write. So close returns a value indicating whether it succeeded or not. So questions about read, write, close? So I talked about the standard library earlier because apparently I should have put that earlier in this lecture than in my slides. So standard out, C out, printf, etc. So they're implemented in terms of read, write, open, and close. So if you want to implement printf, you're going to need to know about read and write. And they add buffering in the process, so that's typically faster because they're not making as many read and write calls. Since read and write are a system call, we have to save all the user registers every time we read or write. And if we're doing that for every character, like our dumb printf implementation in XV6 does, then it turns out we're going to have to like copy all the user registers onto the kernel stack every single character we're printing out, and that's going to be real slow. It's more convenient, obviously, so we do partial, you know, formatted I/O. The libraries handle partial reads and writes intelligently. Like, when they're reading from the keyboard, they just read whatever's there, and they split it up into lines for you, and handle if, you know, they need to call read again because they only got part of the line, whereas you would have to implement that yourselves. And they're more portable. As for why you'd not want to use it, well, the biggest reason is if you don't want the buffering, like you want to talk to another a remote machine and you want to know when, have more idea when things are actually being sent and received, you probably want to use read and write yourself. But often you're much happier using the standard library, and we're talking about it mainly so you know what is the standard library doing? How is it actually implemented? As for mixing it, don't do it unless you're very careful. So if you like printf to a file and then cout, you printf or cout and then you call write, well, you don't know unless you were careful when printf actually sends that output. And similarly, if you scanf and then read, well, you don't know whether scanf read some extra stuff that you're not that you expected to read, because like it read, you know, two lines of input and kept the next line around for your next call to scanf, but then you called read and expected to get that. So don't mix them unless you're very careful. Which for output is fflush basically, or the equivalent in C++, and for input is don't, pretty much. Unless you like, yeah, there's ways of doing it, but basically don't. Okay. So let's talk about one thing that we didn't do. So we talked about how to open and close files. We also need to reassign file descriptors. And basically what we want to do is we want to say, okay, I opened a file to redirect to. So this is my, you know, I'm implementing going to output.txt. So here is my output.txt that I just opened. I want to make it file descriptor 1. So I want to do this assignment. Unfortunately, I can't access this from my library because it's in the kernel. It's not my stuff. So there's going to be a system call which does this assignment. And it's called dupe2. So we call dupe2 with the file descriptor number we opened and the file descriptor number we went to assign to. And that system call does this assignment and also updates the reference count so we don't accidentally delete the struct file too early. And this is how we actually implement this redirection. We open output.txt for writing, we get a new file descriptor, we use dupe2 to make it file descriptor 1, and then we close the other new file, the other file descriptor so we don't waste space in that open files table. So this might look something like this. So we open output.txt with the option saying we want to write to it, we want to create it if it doesn't exist, and if it does exist, we want to truncate it, we want to get rid of what's already there. And then we make that standard out, we close the original, and because we use reference counting, the, you know, sort of our copy, quote unquote, still works, our copy of the pointer still works. And then printf will go to output.txt after that. Questions on this example? Yes.
So this will redirect whatever program was happening to the output test to standard out instead.
So this will make our standard out the output.txt. So we open output.txt, and this is equivalent to doing, I probably should have done this the other way here. But this is equivalent to doing, and that was rubbish drawing. This is equivalent to doing O file of standard out equals O file of FD. And I should have written write standard out is the same as write FD is probably might have been clearer. So what we're doing here is we're opening output.txt and we're making it our standard out. So this is equivalent to what you expect. You know, this implements the redirect to output.txt. That makes sense. Questions? Yeah.
But any other process that wants to go to standard out will also go to output.txt.
So the question is, does this apply to any other process? And the answer is no, because each process has its own table of open files. Because that was part of our struct proc, so we only modified ours. So if we wanted to use this to implement this for our shell, we're going to do this in our child process just before we call exec, and it's only going to affect that process. It's not going to affect our shell. Our shell can still printf normally, you know, and not have it go to this output file, and any other commands we run can still printf normally and have them go, you know, not to output.txt. So I also like to note there's a call dupe, which is like dupe 2, but instead of you don't specify a new file descriptor number, it in fact instead makes one up that's not allocated. Okay. So questions on dupe 2? So this is the basic way we do redirection. So this is open a file, make it standard out, instead of whatever open gave me, which is some other file descriptor. And then I close the original just to not waste space in my file table because I don't need the new FD now that it's standard out. So the last topic is going to be pipes. So pipes, I mentioned, are a special kind of file. So bytes go in one of a pipe, like putting water in a pipe, and come out the other, and in order. And this is how we connect two processes together. So one can write to the pipe, like it would write to our terminal, and the other can read from the pipe, like it would read from our keyboard, and they're in fact writing to and from each other. And there's a library call called pipe, which usually there's a system call directly called pipe. This is what XV6 does. And it creates this special, type of file. And file descriptors open to it. The file doesn't have a name on disk, but we have open files that point to the pipe, and that's what we're going to use to access it. So here's what the pipe looks like. So we have our pipe call takes an array of two integers, and it fills them with file descriptors. So one of them is a file descriptor to read from, one is to write from. So what pipe does is it allocates two entries in our file table, one for the read end of this pipe, one for the write end. And from one process, you can call write, another you can call read. You might say, wait, how do we have two processes? Well, we probably want to fork. Then fork and so you fork, that copies your open files. So when you fork, you still have the same file descript files open. And one of the processes you fork can write, the other you can read. And this is how we implement pipelines. We use this to get a pair of file descriptors, and then we make one of them standard out in one of our child processes, one of them standard in another of our child processes, And now when one writes, the other reads from the other. Questions? This? Yes. In the second line of the if statement, so here, this is, we're calling pipe, we're passing the array. This actually passes a pointer to the first element of the array. Is that way Bruce confusing?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is, so the prototype for pipe is int pipe int star. And it expects a pointer to exactly two integers that it fills in. Okay. So one notable thing about how pipes work are that, you know, this is something you should be able to figure out. So here I have code where I'm not doing this in separate processes. Instead, I have one process. I'm getting the read and write ends of the pipe, and I write to the pipe and read from the pipe. And if I only write a little bit, this will work. But if I write a lot, this is going to not terminate. It will hang forever. So what's happening? You can talk with your neighbors if you... I can get back to that if you ask me. So, any ideas as to what the problem is? Yeah. That's exactly what happens. So you're going to fill. So write is going to write to this buffer in the kernel. And there's some space in there. So if the size is small enough, it's going to be fine. But if there's, but if you write enough, we're going to run out of space in that buffer. The kernel's not going to store like a gigabyte of stuff waiting to be sent to another program. That's a very bad idea for a lot of reasons. So the write's going to hang, waiting for something to read from the other end of the pipe. But nothing's going to do that. And so that's why it hangs. That's exactly what happens here. And if the size is small, you don't fill up the buffer, so it works perfectly. Yes? Because there's only one copy of the read file descriptor, because we didn't fork or anything like that. And the only call to read is after the call to write. Yes? So to make this not hang, yes, we would need to do something like fork. Sorry, this is a lot of code. Fork and write from a, say, the child process, for example. And that way, while this is writing, this read can be happening. And that's going to be fine. Okay, yes. So the question is, can I read and write for multiple threads? We haven't talked much about threads, but for multiple processes, yes, it doesn't do something broken. But you might not read the bytes in the order you want. right? Because you call read multiple times, you know, you don't know which order those reads will happen unless you have some way of coordinating that. But yeah, multiple, you could have the read file descriptor, you could fork multiple children which all have copies of that same file descriptor and all try to read from it, and that's guaranteed to not break, but the reads will happen in some order. And you don't know why. So this is our a typical example of using pipe with actual forking. In your shell setup, you'll do something a little more, you know, do something like this to set up the pipelines. You'll, instead of read and write from, you'll dupe to an exec. You'll dupe to make it standard out, standard error, and exec. Something to note here is that we close the write end. And this is necessary because read will give us end of file when all the write ends are closed. But if we didn't close that copy of the write end, then it's not going to happen because we could still write to it. And so we're not going to get end of file. And we also close file descriptors we aren't using. And this is a good idea because that table has a limited size. This is even truer in Linux. And you can run out. And so, and I guess I'll have our, I'll finish up with, yeah. So this is what you do in, to implement the pipeline, which is very similar. So you'd call pipe, you'd make one end be standard out, one end be standard error, standard in, and you close the other end, close both ends so you aren't leaking any file descriptor entries. We close both ends because dupe2 copied into the original file descriptor and copied the pointer, so we already have a pointer, we can get rid of the other one. So we're clearing out all the entries of the file table we aren't using, and we're only going to use standard in, standard out, and standard error when we spawn these new programs, exec and rep. And this is the pattern you're going to implement in your shell. And you asked me earlier privately difference between dupe and dupe2. So dupe2 here, we're specifying I want to make pipe, the second, the right end of the pipe be standard out. With dupe, we just say I want to make another file descriptor that refers to the right end of the pipe. So we use dupe2 here and not dupe because we want to say I know what I want it to become. But dupe is a version if you just want another file descriptor that refers to the same thing. Yes. So. So any questions on any of these stuff with read, write, open, pipe that we covered today? No. Okay, so the shell assignment should be out, it would be due next week, that's the current plan, and we just went over everything you actually need to go over. We'll probably review a bit on Tuesday, but we talked about all the things you need for it, because you need pipe, dupe2, open, and you may notice that the slides contain code which is suspiciously similar to what you'll actually be doing.